I'm Vicky Mochama, and this is No Little Plans, a podcast about the UN Sustainable Development Goals in Canada. We talk a lot about housing in Canada, but it's usually one type of story, buying and selling. But that's not the only story. It's only part of what's going on. For a while now, housing has been getting harder and harder to get into, especially if you're poor or low income. When it comes to talking about where Canadians live, the stories we tell often leave out the people who don't have a home at all. On any given night in Canada, there are 30,000 people without a home to call their own. Every year, at least 235,000 people experience homelessness.
In this country, about 35,000 Canadians don't have a permanent place to sleep.
So far this year, at least 70 homeless people have died in the city of Toronto.
Five people every week in Metro Vancouver are becoming homeless.
In Winnipeg, at least 1,400 people are experiencing homelessness.
Ottawa's emergency shelters are over capacity.
The financial cost is staggering too, about $7 billion a year.
Government is committed to cutting the rate of chronic homelessness in Canada by a full 50%.
When we think of a homeless person, we tend to see the stereotypical image, which is an older single guy who is sleeping on the streets. But the reality is way more complicated. Nearly a third of the people experiencing homelessness are women. Almost one in five are young people. There are whole families who are homeless, often staying in shelters for twice as long as individuals. And Indigenous people are way overrepresented in the homeless population. Very few people want to be without a home. Can you imagine your life without one? I know I'd struggle to keep a job if I didn't have a place to keep my clothes, to store my groceries, to recover when I got sick, to sleep in on weekends. Really just a place to be human. That is what the SDGs are about. They're all about making sure that we can all live more humane lives. And it starts with eliminating poverty. For this episode, I want to zoom in on homelessness because a home is the foundation for everything. The stats I just gave you came from the Canadian Observatory on Homelessness, where our first guest works. Aaron Dye is a researcher who has been challenging the way we think of homelessness. Later on, I'll speak to Jesse Thistle, who experienced homelessness for a long time and has now come up with an innovative definition of Indigenous homelessness. It can be difficult to know the lives of the underhoused and the homeless. But if we're really going to eradicate poverty, we need to talk about how poverty and precarity pushes people out of their homes and onto the streets. Because to make big changes, there can be no little plans. Aaron Dye is an academic and researcher who works with the Canadian Observatory on Homelessness. Her work focuses on homelessness, social exclusion, and criminalization. She is the author of the upcoming book, Negotiating Exclusion, Reimagining Homelessness and Mental Health. I asked Aaron whether it's even possible to eradicate homelessness in Canada by 2030.
I think that it is absolutely possible to end homelessness in Canada. Whether that can happen by 2030 with the resources and investments and in policies that we currently have in place, that's where I'm doubtful. We know of international communities that have been able to essentially eradicate homelessness. So it really boils down to, are we willing to invest and commit to not allowing homelessness in our country?
Can you tell me a bit more about, you know, what people that we're seeing who are experiencing homelessness, what does that population generally look like?
Yeah, it's a really great question because that has shifted dramatically over the last 30 to 40 years. So before, say, the 1970s, it was a lot of single men and they would become homeless fairly quickly and then would be able to exit homelessness fairly quickly as well. What happened in the mid 80s through to the early 1990s is the federal government disinvested in affordable housing. We had a recession. We had a drawback of welfareist programs and supports. And so that led to the homelessness crisis that we have today. So starting in the 1990s, we really started to see an enormous influx in women, in young people, in newcomers, in people who identify as LGBTQ2S, a whole range of people that were really just not on the radar before, becoming an enormous part of who's experiencing homelessness today.
What are some of the things or elements that keep people trapped in this cycle of poverty and of homelessness in Canada?
Absolutely. The number one issue is a lack of affordable housing. And we can see this in Vancouver, we can see this in Toronto, but we can also see it in rural communities too, where the vacancy rate is so small because there are so few rental opportunities that people simply cannot make ends meet. Incomes have stagnated, right? People aren't making nearly as much money or incrementally as much money as they used to, while the cost of living rises, and including the cost of rent. And so there just isn't enough money at the end of the month to be able to afford rents. So we actually know that about 85% of people who experience homelessness experience it for a very small period of time. That might be for a personal reason. They might have been kicked out or a roommate situation didn't work. It might be because they've lost their job. It might be an illness that makes them unable to work, and so then they can't pay that month's rent. If we invest in affordable housing and find ways to make housing a human right, where everybody has access to housing that is safe, that is appropriate to the size of their families, and that is affordable, that will fundamentally change the homelessness situation in Canada.
You've done a lot of work about homelessness prevention. Can you explain what that means?
Gladly. So homelessness prevention is about making sure we have the resources and the supports in place and structural changes in place to make sure people don't become homeless in the first place. It's once you're in that system, once you've lost your home, once you don't have an address, once you're sleeping on the street or in the shelter, it's so hard to claw your way back up. It is so hard to get enough money together to pay first and last month's rent, to apply for a job when you have no address, and when employers know that address you're putting on is the address of a shelter, so they won't hire you. It is so hard to maintain a job when you are sleeping for only a few hours a night, and it's fitful sleep because you're sleeping under a bridge, literally, or on a sidewalk, or on a park bench, or you're sleeping in a shelter with 4, 8, 16 other people, and you have to sleep with your shoes on, or they'll get stolen. You know, how do you get up for work in the morning and do a productive 8-hour day, right? So once you become homeless, it is just so challenging to be able to move out of homelessness. So why don't we, while we work on helping people exit homelessness, which is incredibly important, we also need to be working at stopping it before it starts. We need to put resources and efforts into making sure that we can help people and catch people before they become homeless, because that's cost effective, it's cheaper for Canadians, but also it's ethically the right thing to do. And so there's all sorts of different ways that we can prevent homelessness, all the way from like very broad ideas like building more affordable housing, poverty reduction strategies, things like raising the minimum wage, access to affordable childcare. Those are all sort of these big issues that will trickle and affect people's ability to stay in their home. And then we have more personal interventions. So things like supporting people who have an eviction notice. Okay, well, what do we need to do now that you have an eviction notice? What can we mobilize to make sure that you either stay in that home or we can move you into another home very, very quickly? Things like landlord-tenant mediation. So maybe we can work something out so that the eviction doesn't happen. Emergency funds, so that if you had an accident or an injury and so you can't pay this month's rent, well, here, we're just going to give you something so you can pay this month's rent and then you'll be on your way.
Are those actions that you feel Canadians who aren't experiencing homelessness could be a part of?
Absolutely. So the Canadian Observatory on Homelessness, along with Vox Pop Labs, did a survey last year that asked Ontarians specifically whether they thought homelessness prevention was a good idea. And overwhelmingly, people said, absolutely, prevention should be on the radar, should be a priority for the government, and especially young people. So it was especially young people who recognized that having an obligation to provide housing should be a government priority. If you have a flood and you're in your basement and you're scooping out the water, but you're not turning off the tap that's creating the flood, I mean, that's just so inefficient. So why don't we turn off the tap? Why don't we find a way to stop the influx of homelessness so that we're not just constantly bailing ourselves out?
It feels to me like that the emergency mode is what we tend to be in, which is, you know, providing shelters, dealing with it on an emergency response basis. You're arguing that we can actually do a lot more work way ahead of that, you know, before people become homeless or when they're, you know, in the early stages of possibly experiencing it. That's where a lot of the work can be shifted to.
Absolutely. So that's what, when the homelessness epidemic started in the late 80s and early 90s, we put in emergency programs, right? This is where, you know, more and more emergency shelters were created, drop-in centers, food kitchens, things like that, because it was all of a sudden we had this influx of people experiencing homelessness. And so what ended up happening, though, is the homelessness crisis didn't go away. And so for years, for decades now, we've been relying on what were actually not meant to be long-term solutions. These were short-term band-aid programs, literally just to keep people housed and alive. We've been relying on them as our way of managing homelessness, and that's just not effective. So what happened in 2013 is the federal government saw the results of the at-home Chez Soi study, which was a study that proved the effectiveness of Housing First, which is providing people with housing and then the supports they need to maintain that housing, rather than waiting until somebody, you know, becomes sober or gets a job before they are allowed to access housing. And so what the Housing First program model did was say, okay, if we give people housing, they are much more likely to be successful at staying stably housed. So in 2013, the federal government said, okay, we recognize this is evidence-based. We're going to now fund and support Housing First in major cities across Canada. So that was a real important shift in our framework and in our perspective on, let's not just manage homelessness. What can we do to solve homelessness? And so Housing First is still happening. It's incredibly important. It's the way we can move people who've been experiencing homelessness for years to help them move out and become stably housed.
People don't tend to know the cost of this. So we were looking at a 2016 cost-benefit analysis from the United Kingdom that suggests that preventive measures focused on early intervention reduce the public cost of addressing homelessness from $56,000 Canadian per person to something like $14,000. Do you think most people have an understanding of how expensive it is to keep people on the streets?
No, and I don't blame them, because this is the thing with homelessness. There is no homelessness department in the government that everything comes from, right? Then it would be really easy. It would be really easy to collect the data. It would be really easy to look at the budget, and we would have a clear understanding of what homelessness costs us and what's happening with homelessness. The thing with homelessness is it traverses all of these different sectors. Homelessness in Canada costs us $7 billion a year. That is spread out across the costs to healthcare, right? When people use emergency services, the costs to the criminal justice system, the costs to the housing system, the costs to public legal defenses, right? All of these different things. And so if you say, well, we're going to implement, you know, this program to prevent homelessness, individual sectors won't see a $7 billion cost saving right away, right? It'll be spread out over all these different sectors. And so that, I think that's one of the tricky parts of getting people on board. It's so interconnected between other sectors that it's hard to see your place, and it's hard to see the specific cost savings for your sector when it's actually such part of a larger picture.
You know, what are some of the attitudinal shifts that need to happen in order to ensure that we're beginning to be in a place where we can start to accept spending that money and also making sure that there's a political and public will to do so?
I think there's two things. From a very personal perspective, I think people need to recognize that any one of us can become homeless. If I have learned anything in the 10 years that I've been hanging out with homeless folks, it is that I could be so close to being homeless too if the circumstances that happened in their life had happened to me. Any one of us could be one injury, one accident, one natural disaster away from becoming homeless. And if that were us, wouldn't we want somebody to help? Wouldn't we want somebody to just give us a chance and give us a roof over our heads? The second piece, though, is then recognizing housing as a human right. We have signed international conventions that say that adequate housing is a human right. And Canada is a signatory on these declarations. And so we need to make that a reality. So the federal government had recently released a national housing strategy, which is very exciting. And it's very promising to see the federal government back at the table after all those years of not investing in affordable housing. This is wonderful news. But we need to make sure that as they're implementing this national housing strategy, it's implemented within a framework that allows for housing to be recognized as a human right, so that even if governments shift and governments change, as they always will, there's an ingrained in our law right to housing.
We talk a lot about types of privileges, but not often about the privilege of privacy. What is that, and how does it affect people's well-being in the long term, especially when we're looking at homelessness?
That nobody's ever asked me that question, and I love that question. As a housed person, I take for granted all that I can do within the privacy of my own home. And so there's been research, especially from the United States, that has shown that, you know, the stereotype that people experiencing homelessness are deviant, are all mentally ill, are troubled, comes from a place where they live publicly all of the time. So I think about all the things that we can do in our home. We can go to the bathroom on our own. We can shower on our own. We can engage in intimate relations on our, you know, in privacy, right? That I can drink a glass of wine at the end of the night. That people who are experiencing homelessness aren't able to do. And so when people experiencing homelessness get ticketed for drinking in public, or for loitering, they are literally being ticketed for being. They have nowhere else that they can stand around during the day when a lot of shelters will close their doors during the day. They have nowhere else. If they're going to drink, they have nowhere else they can drink but in a public setting. And so we criminalize the very nature of what it means to be homeless. And then the irony is, the sick irony is, that people experiencing homelessness are, in that sense, incredibly visible. Every aspect of their day is being watched, is being surveyed, is being monitored, right? But then at the same time, they are absolutely invisible. They are the people that we will walk by on the sidewalk and we will not turn our heads to look at or to speak. They are the people that we don't notice. And if we do notice, we notice by fear. There was a documentary many years ago who talked to people experiencing homelessness in Vancouver, in the downtown east side. They had asked for change so often, and nobody turned to acknowledge that they had spoken, that they actually started to go crazy. They actually started to wonder, am I even speaking? Do I know when I'm speaking? You know, I have the privilege of, every time I speak, people look up or look at me. My daughter might not listen to me, but she will acknowledge that I've spoken. That is a privilege that so many people experiencing homelessness don't have, and that I know I, for a very long time, took for granted, and I think many people do.
Can you tell me about a specific story of someone who took control of their narrative and how it impacted the quality of their life?
The person who comes to mind right away is Jesse Thistle. I have the honor of working with Jesse at the Canadian Observatory on Homelessness. He's the resident scholar on Indigenous homelessness, and he himself experienced homelessness and severe drug addiction for, I do believe, 15 to 20 years. And he is now a PhD student at York University. He's a decorated scholar. He's a Vanier and Trudeau scholar, which are scholarships that are incredibly competitive and difficult to get, and he got them both. And he has become the name for studying Indigeneity and Indigenous homelessness in Canada. And so he not only has been able to use his story and his voice to bring attention to the absolute degradation that takes place when you're experiencing homelessness, but incredibly, he's using now his platform to amplify the voices of all Indigenous people, particularly Indigenous peoples who have experienced homelessness, who have been in the criminal justice system. He's using his work, particularly the definition of Indigenous homelessness that he created last year, to showcase Indigenous knowledge and what an end to homelessness looks like from an Indigenous perspective. So for me, I'm humbled to be able to work with him, and he's exemplary of what you can do when you are courageous and strong, but also when you have support, when there are people who believe in you, where you can go.
This has been super interesting, and thank you for taking the time to chat.
My pleasure. These were great questions. I love these questions.
Now, I don't know about you, but I got a lot out of my conversation with Erin. Thank you so much to her for sharing her thoughts. But of course, I had to talk to Jesse. Jesse, it isn't often that I get to meet a scholar who has a lived experience of the very thing that you are studying. You were homeless for a number of years. Can you tell me how you came to be a scholar and how homelessness impacted your scholarship?
Well, my family has a history of intergenerational trauma. We're Métis Cree from northern Saskatchewan on my mom's side, and on my dad's side were Algonquin Scot. So both sides had competing intergenerational trauma that disintegrated my family. It fell apart by the late 70s, and me and my brothers were put up for adoption. We ended up, actually, my grandparents, my paternal grandparents swooped in and stopped us from going through the system, luckily. I grew up with resentments, not knowing who I was or who my family on my mom's side was, because we didn't really have contact. And that led me in my teenage years to make a bunch of poor choices. That led to addictions. I had a history of addictions in my family, and that eventually led to homelessness, where I cycled in and out of homelessness from the time I was about 19 and a half till I was 32. And the last few years were absolute homelessness. So I wasn't very literate when I went into the system, started going on the streets and whatever. And I thought to get off the streets and to get out of addiction, I could use education to figure myself out, to find out who my mom's people were and who I was. And so I used that as a way to reintegrate myself back into society, and I started looking at Indigenous history and working with a scholar named Dr. Carolyn Podruchny, as well as the Canadian Observatory on Homelessness at York University. I started getting little pieces to my puzzle. It's like, oh, I'm actually traumatized by what happened because of the colonial violence that was done to my family. And in knowing that, I figured myself out. I figured out who I was and what was impacting me. And I used that as like a healing tool on myself, as well as my family and extended family and my nation.
So maybe let's talk about that experience of finding yourself again, finding your people. I know in a thesis of yours, you wrote about how history has helped you find that part of your soul that you thought you lost. Do you think that that reconnection with history is an essential part of how or why Indigenous people experience homelessness?
Yeah, well, if you look at the way that colonial superstructures are set up, there's the colonized and there's the colonizer. And usually it's the colonizer who affects power. Social power, they take all the resources for themselves. And in that process, that marginalizes people that they displace. And in that displacement, there's a loss of history and identity that happens. Projects like residential schools, like the national park system, our education system are all tools that are used to displace Indigenous people, Black and Brown people, of their history all across the globe. And so to reconnect with that history is a powerful tool to know oneself and to understand the mechanisms of hegemony that are working against you to keep you in the position that you're in. So that's kind of what I did when I rediscovered my identity. I started to see, well, look at all these systems arrayed against me and my ancestors. Of course, I'm suffering from homelessness and addiction and ending up in the situation I ended up in. It'd be incredible if I didn't, right? So with that knowledge, you know, we can help and understand our situation and our place in what's a colonial settler state here in Canada.
Now, we like to think of Canada as, you know, being a place that, you know, lifts all boats, you know, in some way we're trying to bring everybody along. But when we look at the picture of homelessness and especially Indigenous homelessness, it seems to me like we're missing some element. What do you think we're missing?
Well, I think a more accurate analysis of the nation's history is needed. So as a historian, I've looked at the macro historical factors that form this country, the fur trade before that, the fish trade. The common theme is economic expansion, right? And so if we look at our multicultural policies through that lens, we come to see that bringing newcomers, you know, from the railway all the way up until today is really about polyethno-laborism. So they're bringing people to work and they're taxing them. And that's what's running the economy of the nation. And that goes all the way back to Newfoundland in the 1550s.
It seems to me then that economic expansion is then built on or requires the displacement and dispossession of Indigenous peoples from the land. In order to profit as a nation, you have to remove the people who existed on that nation. Would that be a fair assessment?
Exactly. And I think that's why we see Indigenous people so much on the periphery. You know, in the streets, even though it's in urban spaces, that's a peripheral space. That's a space could be counted as a hinterland, social hinterland, where Indigenous people have been pushed by the expansion of what I call and what Ian MacKay, a historian, calls the liberal order. And what I mean by liberal order is people that are property owning, tax paying, equal citizens within that. And so Indigenous people, by their very being, fall on the outside of what this liberal order is and what it wants to achieve. And so they keep getting displaced. Many Indigenous people, like my family, have been displaced 5 or 6 or 7 times from their lands, right? And we're seeing it again with resource extraction up in the north, where Indigenous people were originally pushed there. Mm-hmm. And now they want to go there to mine or to get electricity from electro dams or whatever. So they're being displaced yet again because of this liberal order economic expansion that's been going on.
So, you know, one of the goals of the Sustainable Development Goals is to end homelessness by 2030. And it's a goal that the UN Special Rapporteur has affirmed that's something that all nations, including Canada, should take on. What does that look like when we're trying to address Indigenous homelessness? How do we ensure that Indigenous people have access to safe, sustainable homes?
Well, I think a realignment of our understanding of what homelessness is, first off, needs to happen. So Western scholars, housing scholars, look at homelessness primarily as being without a brick and mortar structure of habitation to live in, which is true. Right? I'm not arguing against that. But through an Indigenous lens, homelessness, as I have theorized it in the definition of Indigenous homelessness that I wrote at the COH, is really about looking at a disconnection from healthy relationships with environment and with everything that's within that environment. So, and that's healthy relationships, that's spiritual connection to lands, to water, to each other, to our identity, to our understanding and our history as peoples, to our worldviews and connection to Creator. That's what really Indigenous homelessness is. And we need policymakers to really understand that, to address the out of control and out of proportion problem that we see in our streets today. I think 1 in 15 Indigenous people in Toronto do experience homelessness, and they're just a small fraction of the population. And they account for so much in cities like Whitehorse or Winnipeg, you know, 75 to 90% of the population. They're not nearly 90 or 75% of the population there. So why is that happening? Well, it's this reconfiguration of what the problem actually is that we need to look at to address why that's going on.
So in a paper you wrote called Reframing the Discussion, you say that Indigenous homelessness is not about just having a physical structure, but having also, quote, healthy social, physical, spiritual, and emotional relationships, and that Indigenous homelessness is about not having one's indigeneity. And so to me, that seems like that's kind of expanding out the definition of homelessness to what we traditionally think of and what we traditionally plan for in policy. That's saying it's not just about the physical space. Yes, that should be there. But it's also about ensuring that people have access to their families, people have access to their communities as a whole, have access to a physical, wider space that's healthy and nurturing. How has that definition been taken on in the, you know, homelessness sector, but more widely?
I've heard people say that it's blown up the sector, like it's changed forever the way that people in Canada look at the issue of housing and homelessness. Eric Weissman, a man who helped me write the definition, one of the authors, talks about webs of significance as being home. You know, and this comes from Emil Durkheim. These are very old theories in Western thought, but Indigenous people have always lived like that. And just because a Western academic has said that, it doesn't make it give it primacy over the living reality of Indigenous people who've always said that, you know. And so when we look at the problem through that lens, there's hope, right? People are finally listening. People, you know, like Adam Vaughan and Minister Duclos, and I believe Justin Trudeau has read the document as well. It's rearranged the way that policymakers and thinkers are starting to look at the problem, and it's widened the scope a lot. Now, everybody asks, what do we do? And I'm like, I don't know. I just articulated what people told me to write down and from my own experiences. So that's the next frontier. That's why I'm working at St. Michael's Hospital to try and use that definition's logic, the disconnection of kin, basically, and apply it to medical practice. And, you know, it has to be done in addictions, has to be done in rates of recidivism and incarceration all over, right? The same logic has to be applied across sectors.
What's the urgency in hospitals or for doctors to understand Indigenous homelessness?
There's a disconnect. There's a cultural disconnect with a lot of MDs across the country who service and in many cases are the first point of contact for homeless Indigenous people. And there's things happening where some people who are homeless will be suffering from, say, diabetic shock, and they're Indigenous, will be sat down in the emergency room under the assumption that the MD makes that, oh, that person's someone who's been drinking, who's Indigenous. And I know for a fact that people have died that way. And so that cultural disconnect of really understanding the drivers of that person's homelessness and perhaps that they're suffering from a lack of healthy food, which is leading to problems like diabetes, which appears on the surface like alcoholism in Indigenous people, homeless people, is producing a situation where people die. So I'm trying to step in with the dimensions of the Indigenous homelessness to reteach the way that medical doctors interact with people that are often their first point of contact.
I want to ask a bit more about your story. Is there, you know, is there something someone could have told you then that you've since taken on as a lesson for yourself?
Yes. I didn't realize it then, but I was suffering from all these dimensions of Indigenous homelessness that I wrote down. Spiritual disconnection, disconnection from kin, disconnection from identity. It all stemmed back to me losing my family, you know, when I was a three-year-old boy. And so my grandparents tried their best to raise me, and I ended up in the situation I was in. I was in and out of jail. I was on the streets, addiction. And then while I was in rehab, my grandmother, who was passing away from leukemia, called me, and I went to go see her. And I made a promise to her that I would try to do better. And, you know, she told me she loved me, you know, and I got to reconnect with my grandmother on a really deep level, you know, on her deathbed. And the same happened 6 months later with my grandfather. I hadn't spoken with him for a very long time because of the way I was, and we reconnected and forgave each other. And what they were doing, really, is they're bringing me back into the circle of my relations. I met a wonderful woman while I was in rehab named Lucy, who's my wife now. I snatched her up and married her. And she loved me and trusted me and brought me into her home. She brought me into her circle and made me feel confident about myself again. People started taking time with me at the rehab I was at, Harvest House, and really loving me as a recovering addict and helping me learn to read and write. And so what I know now as an academic is that they were socializing me. They were bringing me back into healthy relationships from where I was. And so what I needed to hear then was that, you know, it is possible and it takes a lot of hard work, but there are people there who will help and bring you back into the circle. And I believe that's the solution to homelessness. You know, it was about not having a place to live, but it was also, and more importantly, about having being brought into the social circle of my family, of my kin, and rediscovering my identity as an Indigenous person.
My mother's a city planner, and so she's always having these really frustrating conversations to explain to people, like, cities aren't just streets on roads and, you know, communities that are planned. She's like, they're people, and how do we account for people? And she comes at it by this very, very African notion where she's just kind of like, who and where do we situate, like, elders in a community tells us a lot. She was like, whenever we plan a community and they've decided to put the, you know, nursing home at the far edges, she's always like, that's just a community that's designed to fail.
Yeah.
She's just like, you tell people that they belong by where you put them or where you allow them to be. And so I find that when it comes to, you know, discussing homelessness, I'm always like, we just tell people constantly where they're allowed to be, and then we get frustrated that they don't feel like they belong.
Exactly. Like, and a great example of what you're talking about, and people ask me, how do we end homelessness? We do like Bhutan. They open their doors to any homeless person in their street, and they have zero homelessness because they do not put their old people's home on the outskirts of town. The old people live with every family. So do people who come on the streets and lose their home by fire or whatever. So it's really about a realignment of the way we're looking at our city space and the way we look at our rural space too.
It's odd that it's novel to be like, oh, here's this place where community is very much
right.
Thought of as everybody is in the community, not, you know, there's not necessarily a need to ostracize somebody. If somebody is behaving poorly, that's actually more reason to give them more attention as opposed to the opposite where it's like, oh, no, you're on the... Now you're officially on the margins and increasingly so.
That's right.
And that's how we operate.
It's like we don't evaluate the systems and the people that are producing those type of scenarios. You know, in Canada and other Western states, we're into a lot of victim blaming, you know, and that, like you said, just ostracizes and pushes them out more into the periphery, right?
You must get this a lot where people think, oh, you're so exceptional. You took these steps and rebuilt your life. And they are like, well, why can't everyone else be Jesse Thistle?
Wow, that's a big question. And I get that all the time, actually. They've said, oh, you're just a bootstrap narrative. No. Like I was saying, it was Lucy. It was the promise to my grandmother. It was Dr. Carolyn Pedruchny who helped me reconnect with my Indigenous identity. These are the people in my social circle who hold me up. I think that's the danger of falsely telling my story, is that it can appear on the surface that here's this guy who did heroic thing and came off the streets, when really the heroes are the people that helped, you know. I believe that's what it takes. I believe that it takes the community to bring people back. Yeah.
Look, Jesse is right. His story is special, but he also couldn't have done it without a community. When it comes to homelessness, we as a country can come together as one giant community to help people lift themselves out of poverty. But like Aaron says, our country also needs an attitude adjustment. Any one of us could experience homelessness. For some of you, homelessness might be knocking on your door. One missed paycheck, one bad landlord, one persistent illness, one natural disaster could be all that separates you from being homeless. You can also be trapped in a generational cycle of poverty. Maybe not quite homeless, but always close to it. The time is always now to make sure everyone has a roof over their heads. In our community of Canadians, that means taking care of families, especially the women who lead them. Homelessness disproportionately affects women. So in our next episode, we'll be looking at the goal of gender equality. I'm Vicky Mochama. No Little Plans comes to you courtesy of Community Foundations of Canada. It is produced by Vocal Fry Studios on behalf of Strategic Content Labs, Canada's content marketing consultancy. Our theme music is by Elcon. If you want to read the paper that Aaron co-wrote or check out links to Jesse's work, you'll find them in our show notes, which are available at alliance2030.ca. It's a website created by Community Foundations of Canada to track SDG efforts by communities across Canada. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, subscribe, and share, as it helps other people find the show. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at No Little Podcast. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts and join us as we look at the big plan to reshape the world.